This is David Lichtenstein. Welcome to Headlines. And this week we have a wonderful program. It's guest hosted, but I was asked if I would say a few opening words. Tisha B'Av is upon us. We're in the 9 days. And it's a sad time for Klal Yisrael. And it's like sad squared with what we're going through with COVID, parnasa issues, mental health issues, estrangement. Just, it's a lot of change and scary change. So I want to share with you something positive about Tisha B'Av, which sounds surprising. But, you know, the Shulchan Aruch in Tav Kuf Nun Beis says that you don't say Tachnun Erev Tisha B'Av. And on Tisha B'Av in Tav Kuf Nun Tes, it says you don't say on Tisha B'Av. And the same reason every Tainus we say Avinu Malkeinu, Tisha B'Av we don't. And why is that? Because the Pasuk says V'kora Elai Moed. There's some type of a holiday about Tisha B'Av, something positive. And I want to talk about the positive in down times. We want to be mechazek each other. So what is the moed of Tisha B'Av? Which, by the way, the Shalah says one day it's going to be a Yom Tov. So here's something interesting. Another raya to the Divrei Shulchan Aruch. The Zohar HaKadosh says that there's Shin Samach Hei Gidin, there's 365 Gidin in a person, one for every day of the year, according to the solar calendar. And Tisha B'Av is Neged the Gid Hanasha. So the story with Yaakov and Sari Shalaisa is Tisha B'Av is that day. And what does it say over there? It says, Vayar ki la yuchalai, the Malach of Esav, so he couldn't defeat Yaakov. Vayiga b'kaf yurechai. And then it says, Vayomer, he saw he couldn't defeat him. Shalcheini ki Allah hashachar, send me. So he says, Loi ashalechacha ki im berachtani. I'm not going to send you until you give me a bracha, a blessing. And from here we see Klal Yisrael has something really unique in the world that we see in the darkest of times. Wait. There's some type of a bracha to get out of it. A mayed, a yomtif, a blessing. So my question is to you, what are the blessings of Tisha B'Av, the Berach Tani? Chazal already say it. Tzadikim hamiduli b'churbana, yoyseme hamidulu b'binyana. The tzadikim that we had post-churban were greater than the tzadikim we had pre-churban. We can achieve greater things in loss, both in gashmias and in ruchnias, than we can achieve in times of, you know, idyllic times, times of satisfaction, times when the greater the darkness, the greater the light. Right? The machshakim hayshivani ki me'aylam, zeh Talmud Bavli. In the greatest darkness, they created Talmud Bavli. So my question is, what is it about Tisha B'Av and darkness that we could take something positive out of? And let me share with you three thoughts. One thing is, you know, you always hear the story, a father sees that something very heavy, Rahman al-Tzlan, fell on his kid. So you have the story of the father who picks the car up with two hands so that his kid could get out from underneath it. You know, most of us settle into what I call the old shoe syndrome. We come home, the end of whatever we did during the day, and we settle into it's a coffee and a donut, and but it's sort of like the pressure is off and we expand, we dissipate, or it could be golden handcuffs. But so many of us achieve so much less than the koiches hanefesh that are inside of us. Like, you know, sometimes we a little bit sleep through lives. You know, let me share with you an amazing story I read. There was a fellow by the name of Adolfo Kaminsky. He was a Yiddela, and he lived in Paris during the Holocaust. His father was a tailor. They found that he worked in a printing shop, and he realized he had an amazing ability to do forged passports. And in Paris, during World War II, he started forging identity papers for the Jews who were sought by the Nazis to get them out of the country. And he learned how to, he saved thousands. They say he saved 14,000 people during his period when he was a forger. And he used to say, keep awake. Let me struggle against sleep. In 1 hour, I save 30 lives through false papers. If I sleep one extra hour a night, 30 people will die. So they say there was one period where they were trying to take Jewish kids, they ruled, they're taking them to the camps. So over a 5-day period, he wrote almost 1,000 papers. So he didn't sleep for 5 days. And finally, the fourth day, he was exhausted and he fell asleep. He wanted to sleep for an hour. He slept for 4 hours. And he woke up, he was crying. He said, 120 people will die because of my extra 3 hours of sleep. But that's an exaggeration. But what's the point? When we're put in a corner, amazing things could come out of it. You know, Cortez, a Spanish general, was brought with a boat with his few hundred soldiers to take over South America, a continent the size of North America. And he looked at his men, and he looked at the mountains, the Andy Mountains, when they docked, and he turned around and he said, burn the ships. So his assistant thought he was crazy. He said, burn the ships. And they burnt the ships, and the soldiers realized the ships are burnt. They have no choice but to go forward. So we have tremendous koiches, and perhaps the key in Berach Tani is, it's a wake-up call. We're in a corner. B'tzar lecha u'mitzucha, what can I get? Im ein lecha kach me'atzmecha, powers inside of me that I ordinarily never would have tapped, like Adolfo Kaminsky, like the Layucha Lashalcha. No, if you know you don't get a second chance, you try harder. That's one thing, the Ki Im Berach Tani of Tisha B'Av. But what's another thing? Let me share with you. Often when we're in trouble, you know, your business is struggling, you have to migrate. What else could I do? Right? Are there options? It forces us out of our comfort zones, and it could open up new vistas that we ordinarily wouldn't have gone to. And let me share with you a story that had a tremendous impact on you and me and Klal Yisrael, the Raavan and the Sefer HaKabbalah brings. He says, in the yeshiva in Sura and Pumbedi Sura Narda, they needed money desperately. So they sent a shipload with four of their greatest rabbanim to try to raise money in the Gullus. They sent Rabbi Chushiel, he was the father of Rabbeinu Chananel. They sent Rabbeinu Moshe ben Chanoich. They sent Rabbi Shmaria and the fourth one who's not known. And they were captured by a pirate ship. Right? He says he was flying under the flag of Avad al-Rahman III, the ruler of Cordova. He had pirate ships, and they were sold. They came to different communities, and they sold the Rabbanim, and the Jews were paid to them. And Reb Chushiel ended up in Egypt, Alexandria. And they say, they this is one story, and he came to Shul the first Shabbos. They had no idea who he was. And the Rav got up, and he said, Adrasha. And Reb Chushiel pointed out that he learned wrong pshat in the Gemara. And this Rav looked at him, and we know even what the Torah was, Chal Hazor Tfila, and he said, you should be the Rosh Yeshiva. And who was that? That was the father of Rabbeinu Chananel, ultimately, you know, the Rambam, the Rimi, they all learned by him. One became the Rav, spread Torah all through Tunis, right? One was Cairo, Tunis, Alexandria, all over Sfard, Cordova. These four Rabbanim spread the Torah that would become the Torah of the, basically, of Girush Sfarad. We never would have had it if they weren't captured by a pirate ship. So this is the key in Berach Tani. Sura lost four of its Rabbanim, right? But the rest of the world got its Torah. All of this is Bekara Le'moyed. Who knows what's the bracha? What vistas? You know, I once met a fellow. He says, I was in real estate. I did terribly. But I had lent money to a fellow. And the fellow couldn't pay me. And he had an oven business. And he came to me and he said, I can't pay you, but you know, I'm retiring. Take my business. And he said, I was so matzliach in this new business, much more than I was ever matzliach in real estate. So sometimes when we're in a corner, It forces us into new areas. Think, what are the new opportunities out there? What pe'er is out there, v'teira b'ermayim, that I can't see? That's the second bracha that we could get from b'tzar lecha u'metzucha. And here's the last, another bracha, third bracha. We discover things about ourselves. We learn things, not about our koiches, but new vistas are revealed to us. We had a guest on a few years ago, Rabbi Eckstein. He said an amazing story. He said he had a child. They had a baby boy. They got married. It was Mazel Tov. 9 months into it, this child started acting funny. They brought him to the doctor. The doctor said, your son has Tay-Sachs. Second son, Tay-Sachs. Third son, Tay-Sachs. The fourth child had Tay-Sachs. So it's interesting. Somebody like that, you know, you could become a Makalel. What does the Makalel mean? The Makalel in the Torah. He was born into a very unfortunate, his mother was raped. He was rejected, no shaved wanted him. He was looking at the most black vistas, and he cursed. But the Torah says, no, a Makalel Azasa. You know what Rabbi Eckstein did? He said, the pain of Tay-Sachs, of losing these children, was so great, I wanted to make sure no other Jewish child should die of Tay-Sachs. So he founded Dar Yesharim. And on our program a few years ago, he said over the story, he said there was one hospital in Brooklyn that used to have a ward with Tay-Sachs. It was a year's line to get into it because the children would stay there for years. He says, I was there when they padlocked the hospital. That's the key in Berach Tani. How does somebody take something, the very blackness, and turn it into a bracha? You know, it says, Be'esh hitzata, u'be'esh atza asid livnoisa, the same fire that you burned it, that's the fire that creates. Eiv says, the phoenix, the bird that dies, that rises, can only come from the ashes. If Rabbi Eckstein never had that pain, he never could have formed Dar Yesharim. You know, the Japanese make a type of pottery. It's called kintsugi. When something very precious breaks, they solder it together using pure gold. And it becomes their most beautiful thing. Here is something that suffered, but look, it made something greater of itself because of what it went through. The paraduma, the ashes that are matire of the world that we could serve in the Beis HaMikdash, that we're can only come from ashes. What pain do we have that we could convert that very thing into something positive? You know, there's an apocryphal story. I don't know if it's apocryphal. This Jewish boy from Florida decides he wants to become a soldier. So he goes to Israel. He's very Zionistic. And he becomes a lone soldier. Those are soldiers that have no family in Israel and they fight. So he's in Lebanon. He's on a half track. And he goes over a landmine. And what happens? It blows up and he loses his right arm. So they get him back to a military hospital. They fly him into Haifa. They stitch him up. You know, they give him this tiny little stub. But they say you're going to live and they give him a purple heart and the best of care. At the end of the day, he can't be a soldier anymore. So he goes back home to Florida. So he enrolls in at Florida State University. And he's like the nebbish on the campus, the kid with one arm in a testosterone-fueled environment. You know, everybody's dating and young and the kid with one arm. So he wants to get his moxie back. So he finds a judo teacher to teach him judo so he should feel like a starker. What happens? He gets good at it. So he goes and he says to his judo teacher, he says, look, could you teach me well enough to compete? So the guy said, look, you know, I can make you where you don't have to be worried about getting beaten up. You take to compete. So he goes online and he finds a real great Korean, an old Korean judo master, a Mr. Miyagi. He meets him. He says, could you teach me to compete? He looks at him carefully up and down. He says, show me what I could teach you to compete. And he says, it'll take 6 months. Every day for 6 months. And the guy says to him, listen, there's one move I need you to practice again and again. So this fellow says he practices it again and again and again. He says, now you could compete. So he goes back to the college. And he goes to the judo coach. He says, listen, I would like to compete. I'm really good. So the guy looks at him. He's missing his right arm. And he says, listen, I'm sure you're good. Show me what you could do. But to compete, you got to have two arms. So he says, listen, if you don't let me compete, remember, this is America today, I'm going to call the ACLU, the NAACP, all the alphabet people, and tomorrow the press will be here by the front door trying to interview you and the president of the college. So the guy gets all white. He calls up the president, the back. You know what? You want to compete? Compete. Adaraba. So it's a few weeks later that competing against Memphis, another university, and as a sign goes out, there's going to be a one-armed wrestler. The guy missing his right arm is competing. So usually 200 people come to a judo thing. Here, like 2,000 or 3,000 kids pack the rafters they never saw. And this big guy comes out, you know, from this big guy comes out, and he's looking at this guy with one arm, and he says, listen, I understand you want to make a message about handicap. I'll take it a little easy at you, and at the end of the first round, I'll give you like a little kick, and you'll fall down, and you'll make your point. So he tries, and he sees the guy with one arm is really serious. So in the second round, he gets serious, and he throws him down, knocks him down hard. And this guy, that one-armed guy's lying there. He sees stars, and the judge comes over, and he says, listen, the ref, he says, let's stop the fight. He says, no. Third round, he knocks him down. He says, no, don't stop it. The other guy becomes a little careless. So one-armed guy sees an opening, and he does that move, and this guy from Memphis goes flying in the air, lands on his head, knocks him out. They raise his one arm, and they're cheering. Yay, you won. After he wins, he goes back to his coach, his Korean coach, and he says, listen, why was that the move that you knew with that move I could win? What's special about that move? So the old Korean guy looks at him and he says, oh, that move? Only way stop that move? Grab opponent's right arm. Which, of course, he didn't have. So what did Chazal teach us? These are dark times. It's the 9 days. It was 3 weeks, Tisha B'Av. And it's a dark time in the world now. As Manav and Magefa, we've lost thousands of Frumma people here in America. Eretz Yisrael is being swept by it. But we believe that in the darkest of times, Ki Yim Berach Tani. And what's that bracha? It can bring out our strengths. Step up. Step out of the old shoe syndrome, right? Maybe go into new vistas. Look for new opportunities. Get pushed out of your comfort zone. And remember, we're missing our right arm. And the only way to stop our moves is to grab the right arm. So the Korei Leimoyed, Kiyim Berach Tani, me and you, these are tough times.
Welcome to Headlines. This is Aaron Parnas. And today's show is about tuition.
Always able to find the blessing.
That everyone's very familiar with.
The new vista.
But it unfortunately does not get enough attention.
The new Koiches HaNefesh in these
tough times.
Although
I don't have the schus of working in chinuch professionally.
Let's go to our guests.
I run a small business for Parnasa. I am the host of a weekly show about various topics relating to chinuch called Chinuch 2.0. One of the most pressing issues we face as a community today is the cost of tuition, which is increasingly getting out of reach for many Frum families. I can tell you from my family alone, we have to pay almost $50,000 a year in tuition, and that's after getting some sort of break. I don't have to tell you that this is simply not doable for most middle-class incomes. And of course, each year, tuition increases at a rate much higher than the cost of living. On the other hand, even with these high tuitions, our schools are struggling. No Jewish school or yeshiva is able to cover their budget with tuition alone. They're forced to raise large sums of money from the community just to stay afloat. We need to have a lot more discussion about this topic so that we, as a community, can come up with ideas and practical solutions to this huge issue. Government assistance for private school tuition, which is always a struggle, and much thanks to organizations such as Agudas Yisrael and Teach Coalition, who devote themselves tirelessly to this cause, is something that can take years to happen, if ever, especially given the current political climate that we find ourselves today. On today's show, we speak with Rav Zev Cohen of Chicago about the halachas and hashkafas of tuition. Can it be taken from Meiser? Or what happens if I get a tuition break and I suddenly come into an unexpected windfall. Do I have to go back to the school and pay the full amount? We also speak with a few school administrators who are the true heroes who work behind the scene of our children's meisters that make sure their rebbeim and teachers get paid on time. And we get representatives from all different types of schools. We are going to speak with Rabbi Nachman Blasbalg, the administrator of Beis Yaakov Borough Park, a large community school that has been around since the 1930s. We also speak with a modern Orthodox school, Rabbi Yehuda Fogel of Halb, where tuitions are usually much higher than in other schools. We also speak with an out-of-town school, Rabbi Yeshua Borenstein of Minneapolis, on the unique situations of out-of-town community schools. Before we begin, I just want to invite any of our listeners who have something to add on the topic of tuition, whether it's a suggestion or a story or some other insight that we could share on a future episode, please reach out to me by going to the website chinuchshow.com where you could submit your comment. So without further ado, let's go to our interviews. We have the schos to speak with Rav Zev Cohn. He's the Rav of Adas Yeshurun in Chicago, and he runs a kailuch for Yanei Chayshem Mishpat. Shalom, Rav Zev.
Shalom Aleichem to you, Rav Aaron. Okay.
Let's start with the first question. So the big question people have is, could they use Meister money to pay their tuition?
Okay, so the answer to that question, the simple answer is no. As Moshe writes in the Tshuva, a person is obligated to educate his children. And therefore, once you're obligated to do something, as it says in Hilchos Tzedakah, that which is an obligation, you can't use Maaser money for. However, this issue, which has come up here in Chicago and in many other cities across the country, is that full tuition is based on what the school can get from the parents who are in the school, which means that if you would divide the school's budget by the number of children in the school, for instance, if the school charges, let's say, $15,000 for full tuition, but if they would divide the budget by the number of children in the school, it would come out that the school really has to pay $12,000 for each child. But since many people don't pay full tuition, therefore the school charges $15,000 and the rest of the money they raise after that. So many parents came with the question years ago, that extra $3,000, can they use that money towards Maaser money? Because that money is not paying for the education of their children. It's almost like a forced tzedakah on the parents who can afford to pay more, that they're charging $15,000, and that extra $3,000 is going to help the parents who can't afford to pay more. So almost all places can hold that $3,000 could be used for Maaser money. Once again, because that money is not being used to educate your child directly. That money is being used to help the school be open for all children. So that's a very nice thing to do. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's a big mitzvah to do, but it's not a chiv. So once it's not a chiv, therefore that could be used for Maaser money. So the answer to the question in the short is, you cannot use Maaser money to pay for tuition. Rav Moshe says even for girls' tuition, where there may not be the same chiv of Limud HaTorah, you can't do it because you have to put your children into an environment that's going to be conducive for them to becoming B'nai V'nais Torah. But if you are being forced, quote unquote, to pay more money than it really costs to educate your child, that extra money can be used for Maaser.
So does the school have to tell the parents how much of their tuition is going to pay for other children?
Well, what the school, that's a good question. That's an interesting question, as all of these questions are. One could find out from the school what the budget is and how many tamidim there are. And that way it's not a complicated equation. You'd make the division, you'll figure out what it costs the school per child, and then that way you can make the cheshvan about what goes towards Maaser and what does not go towards Maaser. We need to have all of our children, Baruch Hashem, in school. Okay, and this is one of the ways that schools have engineered, if you want to use that term, to be able to do it. So it's true, when the parents came up several years ago with this question in Chicago, it must be going back over 20 years in Chicago, so everybody said, you're right, the extra money they were willing to pay the extra money. They weren't saying that, you know, you're forcing us to give tzedakah. But at the same time, it is something that goes beyond the obligation of what we are obligated to do for our children. So that much money is, in fact, permissible to be used for Maaser.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned before, Ramesh says about girls, well, the girls also, because you have to put them in a good environment, even though they don't have a chiyuv necessarily to learn Torah. What about older children? Let's say I have a son who's 19, 20, he's learning in yeshiva and he's going to Eretz Yisrael to learn. Do I have a chiyuv to put him in yeshiva then? Can I use that money for Maaser?
You can still use that money for Maaser because the Shulchan Aruch Harav says you have an obligation to make sure your son knows Tanakh and Bavli, Yushalmi. I don't know if he mentions Yushalmi by name. I don't remember. But you have a chiyuv to teach your child to know Kol HaTorah Kula.
That chiyuv comes to the tune of $10,000-$15,000 a year, whatever it is.
Meaning to say
that you can't use it for Maaser.
I would say that's correct. You cannot use it for Maaser. That's mm-hmm. correct. That's what I mean to say. Yeah. You have an obligation to be mechanech your son. You want to know once your son gets married and now he's learning in Kollel and he needs money to support his family, that's a different story.
Right. That's a different discussion.
Yeah, right. But over there you could use Maaser, but you know, with some caveats which are not going to be discussing right now, obviously. But prior to that, I would say that you could use it for Maaser money. You could not use it for Maaser money because you have that chiyuv to do. Seminaries for daughters, that could be a serious shiloh. Seminaries for daughters, it's also a real discussion. You have to send your daughter to seminary. Should she go to seminary? Is it a good experience? Everybody would say it's a great experience. You know, do you have to send the Eretz Yisrael? No, that's a very serious debate. Very mm-hmm. serious debate. If you want to, okay, I mean, it's really a different shot that you have here on the thing. I don't know if we should jump around, but somebody once asked me a Shiloh many, many years ago. It wasn't even a Shiloh. He was making a very serious point. He was an executive director in an elementary school. And he said, why should I give parents scholarships for tuition when, you know, post-high school seminaries don't give scholarships? So there you pay full tuition, no scholarship for your daughter to go to school for 1 year. And here, where your children go to school for 10 years, and you're getting scholarships. You know, what's the, how do you work that out? That's a very serious Klal Yisrael Shiloh. It's a very serious Klal Yisrael Shiloh.
Yeah.
What's the breakdown for that? And if the taina is that I have to send my daughter to seminary, you know, because she needs it for education, that's one Shiloh. She needs it for a resume for Shiduchim, that's a different Shiloh.
That's a different show. It's for a different show.
A completely different show. Okay. You need an entire show for that show.
Good. Okay, let's go on to a very juicy Shiloh that you told me you spent a lot of time on. So I know someone who had an experience who was getting a break on their tuition, and the school wrote in the contract that we're giving you a scholarship with the stipulation that whenever your financial situation improves, you have to pay the difference the break that we gave you. Is that something that the school could be mechayev a person to do?
Okay, now I want to say something. This is a fascinating question. If you want to deal with the lumdus of the question, and I know, Baron, you come from a family of Gevaldik Lamdonim. You want to deal with the lumdus of the Shiloh, lumdus is incredible, meaning the following. And here's something which has to be said. I'll say it right now. No one is obligated to educate our children except for us. Parents are obligated to educate their children. Father is obligated to educate his child. He's obligated in the chinuch. He's obligated, as I said before, from the Shulchan Aruch Harav. He's obligated to teach his son Torah. Finished. Daughters, all different discussions, but the obligation is on the parents. The school as a shliach is being mekayim the obligation of the parents. Okay, so now we go to the school. Say, I want to bring my child in. I know I thank you for educating my child, being mechanech my child, teaching my child Torah. I know it's my chiyuv. Fine. How much is tuition? $15,000. Okay. I cannot afford to pay $15,000, says the father. How much can you afford to pay? They make the cheshvan. You can pay $7,500. I can pay half. Okay, fine. Now the school says, listen, you can pay half. We're going to take on the obligation to educate your child, and we're going to take on the obligation to raise the other money. Okay. Now, let's say there's no letter yet. There's no letter. In the middle of the year, somebody gets Yerusha, an uncle who is 98 years old, lived a wonderful life. He died. He left his great nephew $500,000. So let's say there's nothing written. What should a person do? They got $500,000, and the school is giving them a $7,500 discount, and the school, in effect, is raising that money. So should they now start paying full tuition or not? The pastor says, without any letter, absolutely yes. Absolutely yes. Now they have money. Now, if you want to know the following, Shiloh, just for one more minute, I have a house that has only two bedrooms, and I have, Baruch Hashem, eight children, and the sleeping accommodations are horrific. Good. So you have a very serious Shiloh. What are my priorities? So go to a Rav. Go to a Pesik. Go to somebody who you trust, who is obviously a person who doesn't work for the school, doesn't work for you, and he's going to be able to give you an unbiased opinion, lahalacha, about what you should do with the money. Now, the school decided that instead of waiting for you to come to us, we're telling you up front that if you get money, we want you to come and tell us. So now the shaila is exactly what the school does. Meaning, do you really owe the school, is loved this for a half a minute, do you really owe the school $15,000? Does the school said, we're willing to raise the $7,500 for you? Or did the school say to you, you know what, you don't have the money, we understand, we're moichel you the $7,500 of the $15,000, you have to pay us only $7,500. What's the lumdus? What's really going on over here? The pashtus is, Lani is daiti, we had a big discussion about this for the last few days in the kollel. The pashtus is that you really owe the school the whole tuition. You owe the school tuition. Elamite school says, we'll take your child in, even though you can't pay tuition. So now, but we're telling you, but if you have the means to pay tuition, we want you to pay tuition. Now, again, if you want to get into alumnus and you want to turn into another show, say, now, should you prorate? Should you go back retroactively for the beginning of the year? That could really depend on what the school wrote in the language. And we did find out that there were two schools. One school wanted to do this and ended up not doing it, and one school did do it. And that is, a person is on scholarship for 10 years. Let's say for 25 years, Baruch Hashem, until all his kids get out of the school. 25 years he's been a parent in the school, and he's been on scholarship for all those 25 years. Fine. Now all his kids are married, and now he's whatever it is. He's 65 years old, and all of a sudden he finds himself with a lot of money. He has no children at home, and his stocks went up, or he got an inheritance, and he has money. Should he pay the school?
Yeah, a nice big bill. It could be a big bill. So $500,000.
Whatever it is. Okay, he made himself $5 million, and he has $500,000 of Misa money. But to get even the Misa money, he made himself $5 million. He got a Yerusha $5 million. Whatever happened to him, he invested in a stock, and it turned into a lot of money. So one school put in that this money is owed to us. And if any time during your lifetime you make money, we want the money. We want the money. One school tried to do that in a neighborhood where real estate was going through the roof. And they said that when your children are finished with school and when your expenses are finished, and now you have a lot of money in your house, you've made $1.5 million or $2 million in your house, it's gone up in value from whatever it is, from $200,000 to $2.5 million in the neighborhood, we want some of that money for the school. We pay for your child. We pay for your child. So the person told me that he doesn't know if they went to Rav Meisher or Rav Yankov, if they were alive at that time, and they told him no. Somebody else we spoke to today also said, it's not the Mahalach. But if a school wants that to be the Mahalach, I'm not saying the school is right or wrong. That's another shiur for another show. But Lamaisa, the school could say it. And if you agree to it, because you want to send your kid to that school, so you agreed. You agreed. But even if that's too much of an extreme, that for the rest of your life you're saddled with the scholarships that you've got. But one thing is for sure, that if you make more money, first that is to sit down and make a real erlich hecheshmer. Not that I don't want the school to find out that I made money because I don't want to pay the tuition that I owe them. That can't be the mahalach. The mahalach has to be that if I make more money, I should be paying more tuition. How you want to decide that? Okay, so saying you have to ask a serious shiloh, but a person has to be serious about this. It's a fantastic shiloh, both in lumdus and lemaisa. But it ties into the first thing I said. The achrayus to educate our children is on parents. Parents have children. They have children. Then you have a gevaldik achrayus to make sure that you are the person who's mechanic your children.
Okay, so this leads us into this question, into the question that many people have, whether they think about it, they actually verbalize it, or they're just thinking about it. But if someone has the choice, they could negotiate their tuition and pay a reduced rate, or they could sacrifice. They could pay the full tuition, which will come at a huge personal sacrifice. Both the husband and the wife will have to make in their lifestyle in order to do it. What should their right attitude be?
Oh, Baron, I have to tell you like this. This question, like every one of these questions, it's a very serious question. I'd like to say the following. I want to tell you one vignette before I tell you anything else. In my life as a Rav for 32 years, I never, ever said the following line to anybody except for one person. One person I told, I will never answer any of your shilas again. It was a friend of mine who moved to Chicago, and unfortunately he got sick. He eventually was nifter as a young man. While he was sick, I went to see him, and he told me that since he stopped working, he got sick, he stopped working, his income went down. And he wants me to know that he was telling me this derech agav. He wants me to know for Pesach, he is only ordering machine matzahs and not hand matzahs. So I said, why? He said, I can no longer pay full tuition. If I can't pay full tuition, I can't be mahadir to buy hand shmura. I'm going to buy a machine.
Wow.
That was my reaction. And I told him that this from now on, I cannot answer any of your shaylos. You're too much of a tzaddik for me. I can't. You got to go to somebody else. I can't. Such a cheshbon to say, I'm not going to order, a hand shmura. What? Who? Because I don't pay full tuition. Okay, so I'm not telling anybody, first of all, nobody should ever get sick, chas v'shalom. I'm not telling anybody to do such a thing. And I am not telling anybody that they have to have an apartment or a house like a Baron Leib Steinman, Zatzal. You know, when you all know the story, when the ceiling collapsed or whatever, there was a leaky roof, and he didn't fix it, or he only took care of whatever had to be taken care of, and he didn't repaint. He said, well, I have to repaint for it. I'm not telling anybody they have to have an apartment like that. I don't know who's going to be listening to this discussion, but there was one rule for the Rashiva Shlita, Shibizekhar Fu Shlema, Sechachal Yisrael, the Rashiva of Long Beach, my Rebbe, Madaf Zayn Namal. Now, what does that mean to be normal? Okay, so I know people who did not send their children to camp all the years because they never paid full tuition. They never sent their children to camp. Their children worked during the summer. They made backyard camps. Whatever they did, their children never went to camp because they never paid full tuition. Is going to camp a necessity? It's a great shiloh. What type of car should you drive? That's a great shiloh. But I think people have to realize the following. Daf Zayin Namal means you don't have to live like you're in a vise grip, that every time I want to spend an extra dollar, I have to think about tuition. I'm not saying that. Maybe some tzaddikim live like that. Those are the people who keep Klal Yisrael going, those type of tzaddikim. But Namal can also mean, do I go away for Pesach to a hotel and not pay full tuition? Right? We all understand that extreme. Go away, pay something for a hotel, and not pay full tuition. How could a person do such a thing? What are you holding? So, do I need a new couch? Should I get a new couch? Should I go away on a vacation? Not a 5-star vacation, a 2.5-star vacation. Okay, so everybody has to know where they are, and that also it would be very healthy for people to be able to have someone to talk to who can give them an unbiased opinion about what may be too much or what may be too little. What do you have to do? What should I do? What shouldn't I do? But I think that your questions and this discussion are so extremely important, because what really is needed is face-to-face conversations. The school has an incredible achrayis. They're trying to educate the B'nai and B'nai Yisrael. What an incredible achrayis. What a wonderful job they do. The Rebbeim and the Moros are all being Moisei Nefesh. Nobody's getting paid $500,000 a year to teach. Not happening anywhere. And nobody's banking any money by being a Rebbe. We all know that. And we all know that they should be making twice as much, three times as much as they're making, so they don't need five jobs. We all know that discussion. Now, after everything is said and done, parents also have to be a part of this conversation. What do I have to do in order to make sure that my money is going to the school? Not the attitude should be, if I make more money, the school's going to take it away. Now, if I make more money, I want to give it to the school. The school's going to take it away. I want to give it to the school because that's my responsibility. So, again, your questions are extremely, extremely important, each and every one of them. And we have to be zeicha to, you know, to get into this conversation in an honest way. And there's a lot of pressure. A person can be making several hundred thousand dollars a year and not be able to pay full tuition. It's an amazing thing. I mean, I'm a little older already, but when I was a kid, you know, the person making $50,000 a year was the gevir. A person making $200,000 a year now with eight children, but their child can't pay full tuition. Not shayach, can't pay full tuition. So, you know, it's a very serious undertaking and a very serious conversation. Like we've been having, like you've been creating, and we should be zeicha to take the conversation to the next level. Not confrontational, but conversational. What do we want to do with our achrayas, with that which HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, with that we have for resources, what should be spent for our children? I'm not saying anything with their bracha, with their school, I'm not saying anything, but I am sure that the more a person takes this into consideration, the more HaKadosh Baruch Hu will help be matzliach with his children's chinuch. But that's our achrayas. That's the end of the day. That's our achrayas.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Cohn, for those powerful words. We're speaking with Reb Nachman Blasbalg. He's the administrator of Beis Yaakov of Borough Park, which I was zeichet to send my daughters there for many years. Shalom Aleichem, Rav Nachman.
Aleichem Shalom.
Just tell me, before we start, how many girls are in Beis Yaakov of Borough Park registered?
Presently, there's probably about 1,700 girls Kenayin Ahara. School used to be much larger. Over the years, kids moving to, parents moving to Lakewood and other places has taken a toll on school. But we're still a large school by far. 1,700 kids, Kenayin Ahara, is a lot of chinuch.
Yes, yes. Okay, so we're talking about the topic of tuition. So how does Beis Yaakov decide the amount that's supposed to, that the parents are charged for tuition, the full tuition fee?
The amount to be charged for tuition basically is a function of the cost per child to the school, soup to nuts. Mm-hmm. We get that number from our accountants, and that is the number that we basically try to get from parents. We ask parents to please cover the cost of their child in the school. In the situation where we know that a person is well-heeled and can't afford to pay tuition, we ask considerably more. We ask less to begin with than many other similar type of moistness charge to begin with. Again, we are a community school. We're not looking to make a profit. We're just trying to get the school to run and be able to pay our bills and the salaries for the staff on time. So we have the formula, like I say, is basically what our accountants tell us our cost per child is, and that's what we typically ask for. From standard parents. Again, unless we know that a person can afford it, then we will ask for more.
Okay, so do you have, is it ever an issue where parents feel why they should be responsible to cover the shortfall from other parents?
So we do hear that occasionally, but it's not a reality because for the students that we have to take in at below cost, depending on the situations, we have to raise funds for them. Additionally, there are government programs that help cover a lot of those costs. So it's not that we're taking you know, that it's the tuition that these people are paying are covering some other child's tuition. That's not necessarily true. And actually, tuition is does by far not cover the costs of running a school. It's a fraction of the costs. It's a very important, the governmental programs that we get and donations and things like that to keep the school running, and a tremendous amount of Siyata Dishmaya on top of all that.
Right.
It's not necessarily true that people are paying somebody else's costs. We hear that from some parents. Yes, we do, but it's not true.
Okay, so would you say that even after a family that could afford it and is paying what you said before as more than the others, is it still lower than, let's say, a school in Five Towns or in Teaneck or something like that?
Yes, yes, considerably lower, considerably. Yeah. Maybe on par with the schools in Flatbush or things like that, maybe even a little bit less than that, but... yeah, we don't have the chutzpah to really ask those kind of prices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so not everyone is able, not everyone's situation it allows them to be able to afford tuition. What happens when you have a child in the school with the family situation, for whatever reason, is the family can't pay tuition?
So that breaks down into two categories. It would depend on whether it's a new parent coming into the school, or if it's an existing parent that went into hard times. That's two different scenarios. If somebody's coming into the school fresh, we try to cut the best deal that we possibly can with the parent. I'm trying to understand the situation, and that becomes the base tuition that that parent would be paying. Now, we try to explain to the parents that that's all they're doing is trying to cover the cost of their own child, which they should. If a parent really cannot afford it, we understand that. But we try to make them understand that if the school is raising tzedakah to cover their child, that they should really be able to tell us that, yes, we deserve that because I can't give you any more than I promised. I tell the parents, you know, who says that it's the responsibility of the school to raise all those funds? If you can't afford it, maybe you should raise something for the school also, whether that be from family, business acquaintances, or even going out on permit trying to raise a couple of dollars. Who said that the whole school has to take care of everything? You have to feel that you have an obligation to the school. We try to people to understand it. We try the best that we can. Yet we're a community school. We will not send anybody away that's giving us a reasonable tuition for their child based on what we believe is the scenario. We don't hire detectives to check parents out to see what kind of cars they're driving or what kind of vacations they're taking. Maybe other maestros do that. We do not do that. We refuse to do that. We will go. We have to work on the honor system, but we try to explain to them that they should really understand that they better be telling us the truth, because there's moral consequences, shall we say. The other scenario is if somebody is in the school already. They've been in the school. They've been paying tuition, whatever tuition we've been agreed upon. They have been paying it, but something happened that caused them hardships now. Well, we will never send away a child for that reason. We will try to reach some understanding with the parent, even if it's in terms of obligations for the future. We'll try to work something out. We'll work with them, but we will not send away a child that's in the school for lack of... the parents are facing a hardship.
Mm-hmm. So talk about what's obviously a large percentage of the parent body can't afford to pay the full tuition. That's just the reality. So what's the process that happens when someone's registering in the school and they need a tuition break? What's the process that they have to go through in order to get the agreed upon tuition?
We tried once upon a time having a group from the board of directors meeting or meeting with them or things like that if we have not been able to reach first base. But at the end, we realized that that does not work well for the school. It doesn't work well for the board of directors. It doesn't work well for the parents either. It's putting them through something that they don't really have to be going through. It's basically myself and my co-worker, Mrs. Grossman, that we meet with them and we try to reach an understanding. And there's no purpose, in, as far as we're concerned, in putting people through the third degree and the bizarreness that go along with it. We just try to level with them and get and come to the best deal that we possibly can. Remember, we are not in we're a community school. We're not in it for the profit motive. We're just trying to be able to make ends meet. That's a little bit different than other Meissens.
Yes, I definitely can relate to that. Having been through that, and it was a very, very bakavadika process, so very grateful for that. Okay, so just leaving off, you see, you're on the front lines of seeing the parents having to struggle a lot of times to just to meet the basic tuition obligations. So what message could you leave off, a little message of chizuk to our listeners who are facing the struggle every day?
Well, in many cases, I think it is. I think it's a question of priorities. I think that many parents have expenditures that they're not prioritizing correctly. I give it as an example of a situation that I had with a parent. I'm not trying to blame anybody, but it's just a question of priorities. I had a parent that sat here and tried to explain to me that they can't afford to pay tuition because they're making a bar mitzvah this year, plus they're supporting a son-in-law that just got married, and they have a daughter that has to go to a seminary in Eretz Yisrael. And I said, I'm really sorry, but Misyagu Borough Park is not a shutuf to marrying off children, making bar mitzvahs, supporting son-in-laws, and definitely not for sending a girl to a seminary in Eretz Yisrael, which is a high-cost item. And the mother just looked at me and started crying and says, well, you don't understand. The truth is, I do understand, but I think it's misplaced priorities. The chinuch of that of your children that you have here has to be reckoned with first before you spend for other things that is, you know, that might be very important, but not as important. I once heard from one of the previous board of directors here, there used to be a president, his name was Bianca Landas, who was in the school, and he told me a story that he lived after the Muhammad, he went back to Antwerp where he came from, and he was involved in the cheder there, and helping the cheder. And he said that the Ger Rebbe, the Lev Simcha, was living then in Eretz Yisrael, in Antwerp, and he had his little child, who's today the Ger Rebbe Zangazan, and he brought him into the cheder to register. And he asked, what is the tuition? What do you charge for tuition? And knowing that he was a Rebbe Shkent and the son of the Rambam, he didn't know what to say. He says, "Was the Rebbe Fashtait? Whatever you feel is a proper amount to pay." So he says, "No, that's not a price. What's the price?" So he says, "No, whatever you want to give." So then he said some kind of a number, and he said, "Is this good?" I said, "Sure. It's very good, very good." Says, okay, so he signed the papers and he left. The next morning, he sees him coming back school, and he walks in and he says to him, why did you give me bad information? He says, why did you ask that from me? See, he said, I didn't say what the Rebbe should give. I told them whatever you want. He says, no, I asked them b'smedrash for other people what they were paying. They were paying more than what I said.
Wow.
He says, that's end of his elul chaser. He says, why? How could you do something like that? and he paid the highest price. He said, you know, he said, I almost fell off my chair. First time I ever heard something like that. He said, but this is the fact. The truth is that if you pay your share and you do the best that you can for paying the schar limit of your children, that will pay off in the nachas that you see from the children. And you're carrying your weight, you're doing what you can. Obviously, when a person can't and he's doing the best that he can, that is what the Ribbono Shel Olam requires from him, and that's what that's what a parent should be doing. It's a mysterious nefesh what the parents are doing, what they're paying. I always call it. I guess in my tefillahs to the Ribbono Shel Olam, I say it's damim tati mashma. They're paying with money, but they're paying with blood money. They're paying tuition. And we know that, but that's the Ribbono Shel Olam's chesbonus, and that's how he pays back with nachas.
Very good. Amen. Rav Nachman, should give you kaiches to continue doing Avodas HaKodesh, this wonderful Maase Beis Yaakov Borough Park.
And may all the parents have atzlacha, and they should be able to afford to pay the tuitions and be able to all the expenses that Yiddishkeit requires of us.
Amen. Next up is Rabbi Yeshua Borenstein. He's the executive director of the Torah Academy of Minneapolis. We're speaking with Rabbi Borenstein. Shalom Aleichem.
Aleichem Shalom, how are you? Thank you for having me on.
Sure, my pleasure.
An honor and a pleasure. And a very important subject matter.
Yes. Okay, so before we start, can you just tell us what your school charges? What's the official full tuition rate for students in your school?
So there's different, we have an early childhood program and we have K through 8 in the school. So there's obviously different levels, but once you start getting first through eighth grade, it hovers in the $11,000 to $12,000 range. It gets a little more expensive for middle school, a little less expensive for 1 through 5, but it hovers in the $12,000 range for those ages. You know, kindergarten's a little under $10,000 and then early childhood's in the $6,000, $7,000 range.
Mm-hmm. How are those tuition fees decided on? Is there a board or do you decide it yourself?
So no, I don't get to be the judge, jury, and executor of everything. We have a board, and every year one of the tasks of the board is to set the tuition for the upcoming school year. We generally raise it about 3% a year ballpark. There's a lot of philosophical pieces that go into this, but one of the things that we've felt is important to do is to keep tuition fairly in line with the cost of education. There are many schools that charge extra for full tuition because of all the families on scholarship, which I understand. And, you know, part of me wishes I could do that. But I feel that breeds a resentment for parents who feel that they're not only paying their way, they're paying someone else's way as a chiyuv. And I think that long run, that's unhealthy. So we really try to line it up. I'm not saying it goes to the penny because you can't get it to the penny. But by and large, if we're charging $12,000, that's because the cost of education is about $12,000 for each kid in the school, barring, you know, particular circumstances. I feel that's what we try to be in line with, and we try to kind of go up every year a little bit along with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so obviously not every family could afford to pay the full amount of tuition, like you mentioned. You know, if it's $12,000 a child, if someone has 4 or 5 kids, and the average income in your area is, let's say, $80,000. I'm sure I hope in the Frum community it's a little higher than that, but still, you can't spend half of your income, household income, on tuition and still manage to eat and pay the light bill. So there's obviously a process that people get scholarships, tuition breaks. What process do you use? What system? How do you do it in a way that's fair for all parties involved?
So let's take a step back for a minute. You really have to decide, as a school, how you're approaching tuition. And I think there's really two approaches, by and large. I'm talking out of town now, where there aren't choices, there is no other firm school, so this is it. If someone wants an education, they're gonna have to come to us. So in a situation, so we're a community institution, someone owns a school. It's a community institution, and our obligation is to serve the community. There's really two approaches. There's an approach that says, listen, the school needs to run, it needs the money, and we need to really get as much as we can out of each person because we're not going to be able to function like that, which has its legitimacy. The one that I personally subscribe to and others do is a little bit different of our approach. We're trying to take a long road here, a long relationship road. The average parent that comes to us in a firm setting is going to be a parent in the school for from the time their oldest kid comes to preschool at 2 years old until the last kid graduates eighth grade, on average, they're going to be a parent in the school for about 25 years. I'm looking at a 20 to 25 year customer. I have to have those glasses on at all times in how I interact and relate, because if I'm going to burn that relationship in year two for $500, I'm going to make a, it's going to be a really long relationship that we're going to be in where there's strife and tension, and you have to ask yourself if that's worth it on multiple fronts. And so really believe that the quote unquote, before we talk about how we do a scholarship, it's which approach do you want to take? Are you taking a long road or a short road? Just if I can, for one more second, the school has been around for 75 years, which is pretty long. If the average parent is 20 to 25 years, that means the average parent's around for a third of our existence. So that's a long chunk of our history to be interacting. And by the way, they become grandparents often in the school afterwards. So you have a long relationship that you want to foster, and you have to have that in mind.
Mm-hmm. So how does it work? A parent comes to you, they have four or five kids, and they're starting out, you know, I guess with the first child, but then, you know, eventually more and more get enrolled. So maybe when they first started, they were able to pay more, and now that they have more children in the school, they pay less. So how do you work around that?
So again, we try to deal with each person individually. The fact that there's only about 100 families makes that manageable. We're very upfront with people. We tell them that we're working with everybody. We've never lost a kid because someone couldn't afford it. We might have lost children because someone refused to pay, but we never lost a child because someone couldn't afford it. We always make sure to accommodate whatever the situation is. And by and large, this COVID year is not a normal year. But in a normal year, if someone requests a scholarship, when you re-enroll for school, you can check off that you want a scholarship form. When we send a scholarship form, we've gone to a pretty simplified form, taxes, W-2, 1040, whatever that would be, and some basic questions about other income, other support, where you're paying tuition to other places, and keep it at that. Mm-hmm. At times, we had really long forms asking a million questions. I'll get to this in a minute. We can get back to why not. But that's how we start. But one of the most important things is we ask the parent, how much can you pay per kid? And the reason I start with that is because that will tell me who I'm dealing with. Am I dealing with someone that's coming fairly? They're making $100,000. They've got one kid in the school and they only want to pay $2,000, right? That tells me I'm dealing with somebody who's not looking at this in a regular way, the way a Ben Torah should. Or they come back, and if their number is close to in line with what I would have said, that tells me that I can approach them in a way that I understand, they understand their obligation, I understand their obligation, and it's not going to be difficult at all.
So basically, it's like two people negotiating as like on the price of a house or on a business deal. This is the way you feel is that it should be a mutual agreement between the two sides.
We try to avoid meetings and even phone calls. Most of it can be dealt with paperwork. If you send in your form and you say you want to pay $5,000 a kid, and I think that maybe you could pay $5,500 a kid, we will send back, you know, we assess you to $5,500 a kid, and then you can reach out to us for a meeting if we feel that we overshot on you. But I try to keep it as simple and non-degrading as possible for people. Billy Martin was a manager for the Yankees and many other teams. His philosophy to managing was that there's 25 men on the baseball team. Five love me, five hate me, and there's 15 in the middle. My job is to keep the 15 in the middle with the five that love me and away from the five that hate me. That applies to a lot of things. In any school, 10% of your parents aren't going to get it, are going to be difficult, are going to work the system, are going to be hard to work with. 10% of your parents are going to always do whatever you ask them to do. The 80% in the middle, you have to ask yourself, am I going to torture them because of the 10% that are difficult and drive everyone through the ringer? And by the way, the 10% are difficult are still going to find a way to get you, right? So now I've gained very little and I've made everyone's life miserable, or I'm going to try to have a process that works really for everyone, that is good, that's easy to work with, that's normal to work with, and then I'll have to deal with the difficult people as best as I can. And I'm not going to torture myself over it and torture everyone else over it. That's really the philosophical piece that we've tried to take to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, shifting gears for a minute, yeah. I wanted to talk about your unique perspective from an out-of-town school, where, like you mentioned earlier, there's no other choice in town. If a from parent wants to send a child to a from school, they have to send to you. That's all they have. On the other hand, your costs are much higher because you have a very limited pool of people to hire. You don't have a large available pool of teachers or a BAM. So your costs are higher, and you're limited into who you could go to raise money, to raise funds simply from the community. And I'm sure they're...
Incredible limitations. Right. If not for the fact that what any of us in this business realize that Rono Shalom's in charge and that he's the one who's helping us, then forget it, because it isn't happening without that. But it's a challenge. It's a significant challenge. In a community like Minneapolis, you have to raise outside the firm community. You have to develop relationships outside the firm community in the business world and make the relationships in other ways. There are people who do business in Minnesota that are from the East Coast. They've got holdings in Minneapolis. You try to make a relationship with them. They're making money off the community. They can give something back. You try to find different avenues to bring dollars in. The good thing is I can sell it as a community institution. It's not one. It's not a boutique school for, you know, a specific alum that wants to go to it. It is a school that serves the community, that takes everybody in as best as we possibly can, and has a tremendous track record of success. So there's more to sell, I think, to someone who has nothing to do with the school per se than to get an individualized school. But it's a tremendous challenge. I don't understand how it works. I really don't. It doesn't. The numbers don't add up. The Siyata Deshmaya is incredible. I'll give you one Siyata Deshmaya story out of many. But there was this also gets to the philosophical piece. There was a parent in the school, a single mother, before I worked in the school, when I was in yeshiva. She had a lot of kids with troubles and this and that, and the school did the best they could with her. And she couldn't pay very much. She was, again, just a difficult matzav. She ended up getting remarried, living in Florida, ended up passing away at a semi-young age, you know, in her 60s or something like that. And left the school money that she had in an IRA in excess of $300,000, which shocked me, okay? Like, I was shocked when I saw that. But it was an example, A, of, again, the Rebbe Shlomo orchestrates things beyond what you can imagine, but B, also, that he was a person that was treated well in a circumstance where they really, you know, could have been treated difficult. And there's sometimes there's a payoff at the end of that you can see. Often there's a payoff that you don't get to see. But again, these things come from places you don't expect it all the time. But it's an inherent challenge, and it's a battle we all face every day on one level or another. That's part of being a moser of chinuch out of town. But it does. It somehow works. It somehow works if you're responsible, if you're straight, it does work. There are tougher times. There are easier times. But you got to try to be a mentor. You got to try to really keep your eye on the ball of what you're trying to accomplish and where you're trying to go. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so being that you're an out-of-town school, you'll have families who may not feel the importance of a Jewish education, but they do, if they're given the opportunity, they will want to send their children to a Jewish school. Do you accept those families? Do you accept those children? And what happens to their tuitions?
So yeah, we will pretty much accept anybody if they're willing to work with us on tuition on some level. If they come in and they're not willing to pay anything and they're expecting everything to be handed to them, I'll be honest with you. We attempted that a couple of times. It ends up only creating an entitlement syndrome. It ends up with the person actually just demanding more things from you because they don't feel they have any skin in the game. They actually think I'm desperate to have them here. If I would tell you some stories, you wouldn't believe it. But you have to walk into it knowing, okay, this person's not a Ben Torah. They're not coming from this culture. They're not coming from this world. I can't necessarily assume that they're ready to make the sacrifices that someone who went to yeshiva, someone who understands what it means, you can make. I have to expect them to do something fairly, and I have to work with them, but I have to work with them knowing by Sherry Shum where they are. And if they're going to be reasonable within that, then fine. Find a way to find a meeting spot with them. You want to try it for a year where it's, tell them, you know what, try it for a low cost for a year, and then if it works, we're going to do a little more. You could try that. But you make it clear it's not about the money. It's about getting your child here. We're putting skin in the game. You're putting skin in the game. But if someone's expecting to be given to them, it's not going to work in most cases. Again, unless they're an uneven evion, that's a different, then they're entitled to it anyway. But if it's just because they don't want to pay, in the end, they're not going to feel the ownership. They're not going to take the achrayus. They're not going to follow through. They're going to treat it like they're paying for it, like they're not paying for it, which never ends up well. Mm-hmm. But you have to be honest and realistic. Someone coming from a different world has a different worldview, and you can't be mad at them for that.
Right. Okay. Regarding the cost that it takes to operate a school, I'm sure, and you see both sides of it. You see the money coming in, you also see the money going out. Yeah. And usually the money going out is a lot faster than it coming in, right? So do you see any ideas or any good examples of where that could be put, you could put controls in place on the money going out where we don't need to spend as much on education and still get good results?
I ask myself that question every day. It'll be interesting to see what this whole COVID Zoom world brings to us. And will there be, I'm hoping that there'll be some more online type of opportunities. I don't think for a class, meaning you're not going to all of a sudden start teaching Gemara online, you know, every day for a school year. But where I think the dollars might be able to start working in our favor in some way is in specialized kids. A kid, you know, you have a math class for sixth graders, and there's one kid who's in a totally different higher level or lower level just because of their aptitude. Having ways that we don't have to hire staff people just to teach one person, to be able to tap into other resources, that's one of the areas that I think we will be able to start finding and forging ways to find some savings. But it's hard because as the world gets more specialized and as the normal gets less and less normal, there's more needs. There's more needs for emotional welfare. There's more needs for kids with special needs. You know, it's like every time you think we've turned a corner somewhere, there's something else that shows us that that's not the case. And we're doing more. We're doing more than a school ever did. I don't mean me to our academy. I'm saying every Jewish school, every school is doing more in regards to dealing with individualized needs of the children as we learn more and as we see more. And as quite frankly, we recognize how important it is that the kids have a healthy atmosphere and all these things. So somehow it always ends up chasing your tail, no matter what happens. But sometimes that could be a sign that you're just accomplishing more, not necessarily that you're letting money leak out. But you have to watch. If you don't watch it, it leaks. If you do not watch where the money goes, it leaks out fast. You have to invest in good people that you have to invest because you're only as good as your leadership and you're only as good as the teachers on the ground. The teachers on the ground without leadership will not go well. And the greatest leaders in the world, if they don't have teachers behind them, aren't going to get anywhere. So you have to invest in your people and then find a way to not be flashy in every other direction and department.
Okay, so Rabbi Bornstein, before we close, any last thoughts that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I really want to just commend everyone, and I mean everyone. In most cases, the administrations of schools, the leaders, the people in my position are killing themselves to make sure that there's a school for their children in the community, that there's the parents are doing their part, trying to supplement the parts that they can too. And in most cases, most of the parents are killing themselves. They're working hard. They're giving a big chalik of their income that they don't have extra of to pay for their children's education. And the kids doing their part, you know, also by and large. And I think if we all approach it, realize, give a yashikayach to everyone, the rebbeim, the moros, the parents, the administrators, everyone's on the same team. It isn't an us versus them. We're all on the same team. We're all really working very hard to do our part. And if the rising tide raises all ships, and if we all realize what we're doing and we're working together, I guarantee you it'll be stronger, we will be stronger, and things will continue to improve and grow far beyond what we can imagine.
Rabbi Bornstein, you're a true inspiration and an example for how all schools should be run. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Shkoyach.
We're speaking with Rabbi Yehuda Fogel. He's the associate principal at Halb Middle School. Shalom, Rabbi Yehuda.
Thank you. Aleichem shalom. Good to be here.
So before we start, you mentioned that Halb just announced their reopening plans for September. Can you share those with us?
Well, we didn't really announce it yet, but I am very proud, actually, of what we're doing. We're basically going a little bit lechumra to an extreme, one may say, but I ultimately believe that we are being sensitive and taking into account both students' needs and faculty needs, and driven by the goal of being in person in school. So I believe even in worst case scenario, we will be uniquely positioned to be able to remain open because we are taking such precautions and setting up a system that will allow us to do that. So it's not really announced yet, but I believe once it is announced, I think people are going to be very impressed and we're going to stand out as a school that takes, you know, being in person very seriously and also everybody's needs, both families, students, and the faculty as well. So
yeah, good, because I think most people are sick and tired of Zoom by now, right?
I believe so.
Okay, so moving on to the topic at hand. So we were talking about tuition, and it's a pretty well-known fact that Halb and other modern Orthodox schools have much higher tuition than in other communities. So why do you feel that's the case?
So I think your preface could be true, could not be true. I don't really know the facts on the ground, and I don't have the numbers in front of me. I do think that there are obviously different needs in different communities and different expectations in different communities. But I think I could speak from Halb's perspective, from where I stand, from the educator in Halb. I'm not in the business office, so I'm not aware of the actual costs of, you know, toilet paper and paper. I think one year we used 1 million papers in our copy room. And obviously, I know what it costs when I buy a package of 500 papers for my house. I don't know the actual costs. The insight that I think I could bring to the conversation is really around educational needs that we have in our building that I ask for, specifically at Halb, and some of the costs related to them. And the goal and the guiding principles that we use by making those decisions. So I'll give you an example. A few years ago, I was at an ISTE conference, and I think this is somewhere, but one area that—
What's an ISTE? Could you just explain for the listeners?
Yeah, so ISTE is a technology conference. There are approximately 40,000 educators that come together, principals, teachers, and I think just about probably a nice number of our faculty have been to ISTE conferences, among other conferences. But at the ISTE conference, I came across a program called the Unified Classroom. And we invest a lot in that kind of professional development, going to conferences with our faculty, which also is a tremendous cost. So for me and my co-principal to go to an ISTE conference, where, you know, flying to Texas, and we're spending 3-4 days in a hotel, and some of it sometimes is covered by different organizations, but very often we're paying for it out of pocket. And at that conference, I came across a program called Unified Classroom. And the Unified Classroom, basically, in a nutshell, is if you had a dream of what you would want in a school, that's literally what the Unified Classroom is. It allows a principal at any point to have a full picture of a student's academic, social, emotional, behavioral progress in one, it's called the baseball card view. In literally in one screen, you could see everything. And it allows you as an administrator to see everything you need to see and make decisions based on reality, not hunches and just intuition. Mm-hmm. So when I saw that, I came to our administration and our business office, and I said, I think this is going to change education at Halb. I think if other schools see this, they will want to follow this as well, because this is the highest level of excellence that you could reach in education. And we started off, the first response from them was, absolutely not. We're not spending that kind of money on that.
I guess it was a very expensive.
A very expensive program. And they said, absolutely not. And, you know, it's the kind of program that even allows you to pick on, it sets alarms. You know, it raises a red flag when a student is absent for a certain amount of time and their grade starts to drop, or when a student is sent out of certain classes, and it's accountability for both the teachers and the students, because if there's a certain teacher that's sending too many kids out of class, it will create a red flag for that as well, and it will even create a red flag for too many kids getting into trouble during davening as opposed to getting into trouble. We picked up information of times that students are getting into trouble, and we were able to park an extra administrator there, and that brought the numbers of reports down. We were able to pick up on certain teachers that needed more support. Sometimes teachers are, you know, nervous and afraid to come to us for support, and we were able to pick up on some of that and support them. But the idea is that that program is a very expensive program. And at a school like HALB, we are focused on giving our parents the top-of-the-line education that their children could get. And obviously, to invest in that kind of a program involves getting the program, training the administration in the program, training the teachers and faculty in the program, training the children in using the program, and then maintaining it. And while we're doing that, we're continuing to go to the next year's ISTE conference and see what else is there out there that we need to bring into our school to improve the level of education and reach excellence. So that constant drive for excellence, starting from going, sending your faculty to the conference, paying for them to go there so that they could see what's being developed. One of my favorite sections of the conference is presentations by teachers who, in their classroom, they created a little something, a little program. And you have Google and Amazon and Microsoft are there buying these programs, but we have had the opportunity to get in on some of those because they are so innovative and new and really at the start, and we're able to use that. So that, I think, you know, costs a lot of money just to be at the top, you know, and at that level where our parent body expects us to be.
Right. Okay. So yes, it seems like, and it's well known actually, that HALB is a very avid user of technology in the classroom. I know that even in Limud HaKodesh, I think the lower school has started to use the Lomdei program and other programs that are designed for Limud HaKodesh. Are you using it in the middle school yet?
We're very advanced in the middle school. We have many different programs that we use, but one of the programs that we were first on is an amazing academic tool called Merkava. You may be aware of it, but there's most of us know Merkava as a Daf Yomi tool or getting the translation, but we actually were able to adapt Merkava. It's sort of stalled right now. I'm not sure where they're holding. They don't really have, I don't know where they're up to right now, but for a while we were developing our standards together with them and in their program. And it was very helpful to help with the way we teach Gemara, which is the structure of the Gemara and standards. But yeah, technology is a very important piece in the middle school as well.
Okay, yeah. So this, it's going to lead up to my question, which might be a little upsetting for you and Chinuch and others listening to this question. Let me just jump right in. I have a friend who runs a bakery, a large bakery, and his biggest cost in running the bakery is the payroll. You know, even more than the cost of goods, it's just the raw materials, just all that staff and all that manual labor that's needed to make the bread, the challah, the cookies, is very expensive. So he told me that he goes to trade shows all the time to look for machinery and equipment that can automate the process and take as many workers out of the process as necessary, because that's all going to add up down. It's all going to pay for itself down the line. So, not to compare students to bakery, but do you see all this technology in some way down the line going in the direction of being able to reduce the staff that's needed to properly educate our children?
It's a great question. It does upset a lot of people, but I think it's an important question to ask, specifically during these times when technology took a major role in education last year. I think you mentioned when you started asking me about what HALB's plans are for the future, you made a comment that I think everybody's done with Zoom. I think if there's something that we've learned over the last few months is that nothing could replace a teacher. There's a lot more that is happening in the classroom than simply the transmission of information and academic material. That is just a piece of it. I want to give you a picture of what our 6th, 7th, and 8th grade halacha curriculum looks like for the girls, where it's a perfect immersion of technology and the power of the teacher in the room, and how that could not simply be replaced by removing the teacher or even, you know, getting rid of the teacher in any major way. So we have what's called a self-paced class. So our 6th grade, 7th grade, and 8th grade, the girls come into their class, and the entire curriculum for the entire year is set up on a learning management system from start to finish. So there are videos by their teacher on there. There are activities that they do, and they usually do it in groups. Sometimes they'll do certain assignments or certain work on their own, but usually they're working in small groups of 2 to 3 girls, and they're learning the entire, in 6th grade, entire Lama Tes Melachos. In 7th grade, they're doing Lashon Hara, they're doing Brachos, and in 8th grade, they're doing Kashrus, and among other, you know, Dine Chagim and everything else as well. But throughout the process, students are learning. Like, we're in the business of students learning. We're not so much in the business of teaching. We're more in the business of students learning. As teachers, we're there to enable them and set them up and support them to learn. So the learning process is happening almost without the teacher in the room. However, there's a very important role that the teacher plays. The teacher is sitting at their desk and has a schedule where students are meeting with the teacher one-on-one. Now, a computer could technically read and say, you came in today, you did 5 lessons, and you knew this and you didn't know that, right? But it's really much more difficult for the teacher to come in and now figure out what's going on. So now this student comes into the classroom on any given day, and there's something going on in the student's life, right? And this student, for example, if there was just a computer there, the computer would give you a diagnosis of this kid is either ADHD or who knows what, because the student is not being focused. And the computer is literally recording data and information, but it could never give you that full context. As much as artificial intelligence you have, you're never going to get to that point where the teacher is going to come in and notice that this kid is down on that day and say, hey, what's going on? Now, if that teacher wouldn't do that, this student may potentially move on from level to level and fail. And the computer is going to give you great information. This student is failing. And then the computer is going to create an intervention. But the student's going to fail the intervention. And the student's going to continue to fail. And then ultimately, it will lead to nowhere. Whereas if the teacher is in the room in person and notices something's down, that teacher could jump on that opportunity and get that kid on the side and work with that kid and build the kid up and bring the kid to where they need to be. And now you just saved 6 months of the kid's academic career.
Okay, but couldn't the computer, just to play devil's advocate over here, couldn't the computer notice something's not matching eventually? Like, the algorithm could be sensitive enough, the computer can alert someone. So even if the teacher is not technically in the classroom, an elite alert a principal, alert a guidance counselor, or someone who operates on a greater level, that there's a problem here and they could step in.
Right. And I think that's a great question. But at the same time, you know, part of what a teacher is doing is spending months on developing a relationship and getting to know the kid. If you could imagine, you're the kind of kid that suddenly the computer picked up that something's going on in your life, and suddenly this random person walked into the room and said, hey, why don't you tell me how you feel? I want to get you back on track. It's not going to work. It's not going to happen. There's a deeper relationship that's developing that's going to remain over time. You know, we had a Rebbe during Zoom. We found out that he was visiting students every single Friday and every single Erev Yontif and saying good Shabbos to them. He's an older Rebbe, and he was endangering himself, basically, for his students. A computer will never show a student that I care about your future so much that I'll be moser nefesh for you. I'll put myself out on the line for you. That can only be done by the person in the room. And that Rebbe, actually, that same Rebbe, and many of the other Rebbeim and Marot in our school, you know, when he teaches an honors class, and when his students fail, he goes to their house and he learns with them, and he makes sure that they know what they missed so that next time around. So if you can imagine, you're a kid that's not motivated or something's going on and you're just getting turned off to learning Gemara, and the same thing is for math and science across the board, because our teachers and we try to have a faculty that's like that, that is going to go over the top, and those little moments of showing those students could do something that a computer could never do. It could turn that student around, and a computer could never ever make that change for that student. It could never show care. A computer can't show emotion. It can't show love. And a lot of these children need that. They need that to motivate them, to get them to, you know, improve or get back on track.
Okay, so just to close off, one last question over here regarding tuition. You know, the parents in your school and all schools, but let's focus on your parents spending thousands and thousands of dollars every year on each child. And if with a family of three or four children, they're spending upwards of $50,000 a year just to send their kids to get a yeshiva education. So, it's really like a two-part question. How is Halb concerned with the amount of money that they are spending? How does Halb show their concern? And how do they respect the sacrifice that the parents are making?
Okay, great question. I think it's a very hard thing to show, because nobody's aware that when my Rebbe created a color-coded pamphlet of a handout of the entire Gemara that he's teaching, and we go to the printing store and we give it to them, and our business office calls me and says, Rabbi Fogel, you're about to spend $800 on printing papers. Do they really need to be in color? And I say, well, you know, this Rebbe really believes that this is going to change the way he could teach these children. Then the business office has certain checks in place on that. And what happened in that situation was they said, well, how about we do 1 month at a time and let's actually see if the education changes. And if the education improves to the extent that we think it's worth it to spend $800 so that the boys have a color-coded sheets, then we will do that. I think there's, you know, at least at Halb, and again, I don't know how other schools work, but at Halb, there's a very, you know, I dread when Richie Hagler's calling me on the phone, because I know that if I don't have good answers for him, he's going to call me out, and he's not afraid to do that. And he'll do that to anybody. And if a Rebbe is ordering, you know, food for a barbecue and he doesn't get the tax deduction that we're supposed to get and use the right methods of ordering, we'll get called out on that. And I think over the past few years, we've stopped a lot of the little charges that we used to annoy parents with. $10 for a Hanukkah mesiba, $10 for Purim carnival, small trips. We stopped charging. If the charge for a trip is less than $15, we're not going to charge parents for it anymore. We used to charge parents that sometimes we would charge parents $6 for something. And parents are like, really, $6? You're charging me $6? And I understand that. And I think that that's how we are showing parents, but I think we probably could do a better job. But it's very hard to get that message out, because every time those inner conversations happen, it's not public. But I think even more important, I think the message that we are giving to the parents, and this year we had our head of school led this, but we had a State of the Union where we invited the entire parent body down and we presented what we're doing. We showed the parents that what you're getting for the money, for your tuition, is a top of the line education for your child, both Limudei Kodesh and general studies. And when parents feel that they're not getting a good product for their tuition, then I think they have a right to come to the school and say, why am I paying so much money? And then the school has to be reflective and think, why are our parent body feeling like it's not worth the tuition? Parents should feel that the money that they're paying for tuition is money well spent. And it's the yeshiva's job to be reflective and look in inside and see, what are we doing that we could be better at, so that the parents feel that every cent that the yeshiva is spending is on something that is worthwhile and meaningful for their child. The second part that I would just, you know, add to that is, I really don't think that the average Rebbe or teacher that is getting paid in a Halab school is, you know, is on the higher end of the pay grade. None of them are getting medical. None of them are getting pensions. And most of them are working 3-4 jobs. And I think Rav Palm once wrote in a letter that nobody really travels the other way around. You know, nobody really goes from business and says, you know, I'm a successful lawyer. These Rebbeim seem to be rocking it. I think I'm going to go become a Rebbe right now. And Rav Palm said, you know, it's very easy to look in. And, you know, I had a principal, Rabbi Zinberg, who used to say, you know, if parents only knew what, you know, and COVID really speaks to this in on a very high volume of what it means like to be home. And, you know, how stressful was it to run school in your house with, you know, 4, 5 kids, 6 kids, 7 kids? You know, Rabbi Zinberg used to say, we're all nuts for agreeing and somehow enjoying wanting to get into a classroom with 25 seventh graders who are spitting spitballs and at times are being disrespectful. And, you know, we have to somehow become amazing, successful Rebbeim. I think it's a very it's a very specific talent. And at least the people that we have at Halab, you know, we have an unbelievable faculty. Most of our faculty are there for years, and they're professionals, they're educators, they're mechanchim, the teachers are professionals. They care about their students, they love their students, and you can't fake it. Technology can't show the love, and if the Rebbeim and the Marod and the teachers and the faculty are top of the line, and the parents feel like they care about their children, I think they're okay with. I think they're okay, or at least they. No one's necessarily okay with spending the money, but I think they at least feel that they're getting something valuable for their money.
Rabbi Fogel, it's great speaking to you. I see a lot of the students in Halab, live in my neighborhood, doing great work. Keep up the Avodas HaKodesh.
Thank you very much.